Happy Election Day. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. On this Election Day, we will examine democracy and ask, does democracy work? We are going to talk with a guest who argues that democracy is inefficient, messy, and exasperating, but says that representation in the United States is alive and well. And we'll wonder if you agree or not. And we will wonder what questions you have. And we'll wonder what thoughts you might have. Do you have a problem with our democracy? What's your fix to that problem? What's good about democracy? And what do you think is working? 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. And while it is Election Day, and I know the races and the candidates are on your mind, we do have a policy to discourage electioneering on the air on Election Day. So we want your thoughts on the state of our democracy, but please no specific names or name-calling on the show today. Let me welcome our guest. Mike Wagner is an assistant professor in the School of Journalism and Mass Communication and the Department of Political Science at UW-Madison. He's an expert on American politics, political communication, political behavior, and religion and politics. His piece, Does Democracy Work?, was recently published in On Wisconsin magazine. He's also working on a book, Beyond the Left-Right Divide. And he joins us in the studio. Good morning.
Good morning. It's a pleasure to be here.
Happy Election Day to you.
You know, I'd come to do a lot of electioneering and name-calling, so I'm not sure what we're going to talk about here.
I'll have to turn your mic off. That's what I'm going to do if anybody decides that would be a good idea. But we'll get into the details as we go along this hour. But let's boil down to the question that's asked. Does democracy work? What's your short answer here?
The short answer is that sort of, right? Democracy is, you know, as Churchill said, the worst form of government except for all the other ones. And it's very inefficient. It's messy. It's exasperating. It's negative. It's contentious. And on average, when the majority expresses its will, lawmakers tend to try to do things that follow the majority will. It doesn't always happen, but it happens enough for us to conclude that there is some representation going on both at the federal and state levels. States that elect more liberal legislatures pass more liberal laws, and when the nation becomes more conservative ideologically, they elect more conservatives who pass more conservative laws. And so it's not clean, and it's often not fun, but we, you know, are getting the democracy, you know, that we earned.
Yeah. So what do you say to someone, especially in a state like Wisconsin that is pretty divided in its politics? I am not being represented, someone might say. 50% of the electorate is
right.
Not being represented. So what's working about that?
Democracy is a, you know, majority rule enterprise. And so if 50.1% of the people say we want Governor Walker to remain governor and 49.9% say we would like Mary Burke to be the governor, Mary Burke does not get to be 49.9% of the governor. Governor Walker would just be the governor. And so it's a winner-take-all system. And so there are a lot of people who aren't getting what they want. And so from that point of view, you could say democracy is not serving them well. On the other hand, democracy is for losers, which is to say that if you don't get what you want in an election, there's always another election. You can always try again. And you have lots of different avenues with which to try at the city, county, state, and federal levels to try to elect candidates that match your views or at least match them better than the people who are in charge if you don't like the people who are in charge. And so there's always a chance for you to try to do something about the situation you find yourself in, which is not the case in places that aren't democracies.
So when you say that democracy can be inefficient, messy, and exasperating, what's so difficult about democracy? What and why?
Well, it's the founders that we laud a lot that caused a lot of these problems, but a lot of these problems also tend to serve us well, right? So we have a system where we have a federal system of government. So there's a federal government that makes laws. There's a state government that makes laws. Sometimes those laws conflict. So there's a problem. You have the separation of powers. And so somebody has a good idea, or what they think is a good idea, to make the country a better place. They propose it, say, in the House of Representatives. The House might be divided, but the majority comes down on the side of saying, yes, let's try this. Now the Senate has to pass the exact same law. Well, the House and the Senate don't always have the same majority party, and so there's a problem. The Senate might pass a law that's similar but different, so now the House and the Senate have to form a committee to get together and write the same law so they can go back and pass the same law, but now it's different than the side that each side supported, and so that's a hurdle. Then they both pass it, and then the president might say, well, gosh, I don't like this. I'm going to veto it. And unless you have large enough majorities in both the House and the Senate to override the veto, that good idea is done. Or the president could say, yes, I think this is great too. And then the Supreme Court could say, oh no, we're sorry, this is not constitutional. And so we're going to strike this law down or parts of this law down. And that might make people feel frustrated. So just with one good idea has to go through so many layers where there are partisan and institutional hurdles, you know, around every corner. And so it's even the case in the Senate where if a majority of senators say, hey, we like this, but they don't have 60, that idea could be filibustered, which is to say there could be endless debate. And unless there's enough votes to override the filibuster, nothing happens. And so there are lots of different ways that opportunities for progress can get hamstrung in our democracy, which is really a Republican democracy, which is to say we elect people to represent us. We're not all voting on every single issue in a pure democracy. We have a republic, which is to say I vote for you, you go do what I want you to do, and I'll check in with you when it's election time.
I'm glad that you brought that up, because we do have callers who will correct us, saying we do not have a democracy, we have a republic.
That's right. That's technically right.
Yeah. Why don't we have more Congress members working together, while we might have some conservatives and liberals? Isn't there something that's in the middle that could pass both houses and the president would like as well?
Sometimes. But the middle isn't always the most virtuous place, right? Just because there is a middle doesn't make the middle the right answer, right? So sometimes there's just a right and a wrong, right? There's, you know, slavery is wrong, and to compromise in the middle doesn't advance the ball so much, right? So part of the issue is sometimes the middle is useful and good, and other times the middle is not so useful. And other times there are issues that just don't lend themselves to a middle, right? If you think that abortion is murder, there's not a middle ground for you on that issue. And if you think that a woman has a fundamental right to choose, there's not a middle ground for you on that issue. And so it's difficult to compromise on those issues. On the other hand, the issues where you can have those compromises, one reason it's so hard is that our lawmakers are increasingly polarized, which is to say, their ideas are further and further apart from each other. So if you could imagine just a scale where on the left-hand side of the scale are the most liberal policies you could imagine, and on the right-hand side are the most conservative, our lawmakers have been inching to the left and to the right in each party for a long time. And actually, in the last couple of decades, the Republican Party has moved a little bit more to the right, and the Democrats have more or less stayed where they've been at, but they're still getting farther apart. The distance between the two parties is a greater distance to traverse to make a compromise. So if on a scale of 1 to 7, I'm a 3 and you're a 5, we can compromise at 4. But if I'm a 1 and you're a 7, I might not want to travel all the way down to 4 to compromise with you. I'd rather just keep things the way that they are than compromise my principles.
And are, for the sake of discussion, the parties becoming more, extreme? And you said the Democrats were kind of staying where they are, but the Republicans were becoming more conservative. Is that because of our system that at primaries, it's the extreme voter that turns out?
So part of the story here is voter turnout. And so, as you say, in primary elections, most Americans don't bother to vote in primaries. The people who vote are the ones who are the most interested, and also people who tend to have the most strongly partisan views. And when they're strong partisans, they also tend to have more extreme attitudes. And so I don't mean extreme in a negative way. I just mean further to one direction than another. And so when these folks show up to vote in primaries, they tend to prefer candidates who are like them, which is how most of us are. And so there are opportunities in primary elections to select candidates who are more extreme than maybe has a good chance to win the general election, or maybe matches the general ideological view of that particular district or state. And we've seen that in the last couple of midterm elections in particular, where elections where we thought, gosh, the Republicans are going to win this election. And then we had the primary and a candidate who was more conservative was selected, and the Democrats ended up eking out a close victory. We had that happen in the Nevada Senate race in the last midterms, the Delaware Senate race, and a few others in the last presidential. And so when these things happen, you can point to primaries as being one part of this. But part of it is just the parties are, you know, Republicans and Democrats see the world differently, and they have different ideas about what works better. And as they get more sophisticated about what they want and who their voters are, they become a little more ideologically pure than they were, say, in the 50s and 60s.
We are talking about democracy and wondering if it works or not. What do you think? 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk at WPR.org. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine, talking about democracy, talking with Mike Wagner, who's an assistant professor in the School of Journalism and Mass Communication and the Department of Political Science at UW-Madison. He wrote a piece for On Wisconsin Magazine, Does Democracy Work? And we thought that that would be an interesting question to ask on Election Day. And it looks like we were right, as our lines are full. Let's go to Brad in Plover. Hello, Brad.
Hi there. Since 1992, the Democratic Party has been drifting further and further to the right and has become a corporatist party. I would disagree with your guest on that. And with regard to money and politics, Franklin Roosevelt said, government by organized money is just as dangerous as government by organized mob. I think that has never been more true, perhaps, than what it is today, at least since the days of the robber barons. GTAC, that mining company up north, they contributed $700,000 to
government. Yeah, so money talks. I guess I don't want to get into some specific issues in the campaign on Election Day, not knowing where it's going to go. But organized money is the same as organized robbers. What was that quote? But anyway, Brad thinks that democracy is not working because there's too much money in politics.
Yeah, I don't think Brad would have a hard time finding a lot of Wisconsinites and Americans who agree. You know, money in politics is incredibly unpopular for the most part. And, you know, while we've been looking at divided polls for governor and attorney general and a variety of other races around our state and others, when you ask people if they think there's too much money in politics, you know, people from both sides of the aisle generally say, yeah, that's a real issue. And it's not... You know, there are good reasons to be skeptical of money in politics. A famous political scientist who did most of his work in the 40s, 50s, and 60s named E.E. Schatzschneider argued that, you know, in his book, The Semi-Sovereign People, so you kind of see where he's going here, he made the argument that we have this pluralist society where different kinds of groups can organize and advocate for what they want. But the flaw in our pluralist heaven is that the heavenly chorus sings with an upper class accent, which is to say that people with more money have more say in politics. And a very recent book called The Unheavenly Chorus, playing off of Schatzschneider's words, makes the same argument that people with higher socioeconomic status, you know, and the like are far more likely to have voice in American politics. They're more likely to participate. They're more likely to get the kinds of things they want from their lawmakers. But the caller's also talking about donations, right? Money that's given to candidates. And here, the political science research flouts conventional wisdom about money in politics. So the evidence from scholars who study this, which is not something I do, so I'm just telling you what other folks have found, is that the more money incumbents spend when they're running for re-election, the harder it is for them to win. So in other words, when an incumbent is in trouble because the citizens are dissatisfied with that person because of a vote they cast, or because they're dissatisfied with the general state of the economy, or that incumbent is of the party of the president and they don't like the president, spending more money does not help you win. And in fact, it's correlated with doing worse at the election polls, because when an election is competitive, more money is being spent. And when an election is competitive, you're more likely to lose than to win. And so there's not a lot of evidence that money can buy an election. There is evidence that money can get you access to lawmakers, mm-hmm. can get you access to having lawmakers not pursue particular policies to keep the status quo for large moneyed interests, or to pursue policies that help interests that happen in a way that are outside of public view. Like, you can imagine power in our society is in two ways, right? You could say the government has power over us because they compel us to do things like buy healthcare and coverage, or we have to pay a penalty. But there's also a power where things happen without us being aware of it. And often money is one of the levers that drive that kind of power, the second face of power, where we don't see things happening behind the scenes. And it could be because access that individuals and companies and groups get to lawmakers because of the donations they give could be causing some of those problems. And though the history of our country is that by and large, the majority largely gets what it wants from its lawmakers, the last few years have seen a decrease in that general finding, and some people have pointed to money as being one of the causes.
We'll go to Charles in Wausau next. Hello, Charles.
Hey, good morning. You know, I agree with most of what you're saying, that democracy is mostly working, but there is a single great threat to democracy currently, and that is gerrymandering. It's redistricting. It's the way that instead of citizens choosing their elected officials are in a position to choose their electors.
Right.
And that's been a terrible flaw.
Yeah. Every state does redistricting differently. And the states where the districting process is more partisan, not surprisingly, produces lawmakers that are more extreme in their partisan views. And the caller is exactly right that, it certainly doesn't pass the smell test to say the lawmakers should be deciding for themselves what districts they will represent and whether and who they will stand in front of to say they should have another chance to represent them. And states where the state legislature does redistricting, have far more contentious districting procedures and are far more likely to have those go to court than other places. A state like Iowa says, we're not going to split counties in half. We're going to follow particular rules and have a nonpartisan commission be in charge, tend to have much more equitable outcomes and much less really peculiar looking districts and far less kind of partisan gerrymandering. On the other hand, the Supreme Court has said that it's constitutionally permissible to draw districts in such a way that might increase the likelihood of a minority group having a majority in a particular congressional district. And so some of the districts that look the weirdest are drawn in such a way to make it more likely that the district is a majority of minority voters. And the court has said that that's okay. But the court also says you have to keep communities of interest together. And they generally define communities of interest as a county. And so those are two principles from the Supreme Court that are at loggerheads. Sometimes counties have to get divided for population reasons, but more often they're divided for partisan reasons. And as the caller points out, when that happens, we might be producing more extreme lawmakers. Although the research on gerrymandering as a cause of polarization has found that gerrymandering is not that strong of a cause. And the biggest piece of evidence scholars throw out is that the Senate is becoming just as polarized as the House. And the Senate doesn't have districts. Right. It's just the state lines. And so it can't just be gerrymandering if the Senate's going through the same kind of process.
David on Facebook says to another listener, when you say elections are bought, you are really saying that the electorate is stupid or you don't trust them. You won't say it, but that's what you mean. Money buys ads. What the voter does with those ads, I choose a mental flush, is up to that voter. So
I like a mental flush. I like that phrase. That's an interesting point. When we think about money in politics, and as the Facebook commenter points out, the main thing money is buying at this time of year is television advertising. And it's certainly right that, people are under no obligation to believe a political ad that they see on television. The effects that these kinds of ads can have on people vary to the extent that both sides are competing equally, right? So if one message is flooding the airwaves and another message isn't getting much attention, It becomes really hard to resist that persuasive message over and over and over. We see the message more and more. We might start to think other people are being persuaded by that message, and we might want to, you know, make sure that we're in line with our friends and neighbors. And so there's a complex series of processes that might happen in competitive and non-competitive communication environments, which is to say competitive ones are where you see the Governor Walker ad, and then you see the Mary Burke ad, and you see them all through the Badger game and all through whatever else you happen to be watching on television. And then the non-competitive where you just see one side, right? We've seen a bunch of ads for Congressman Ryan, not so much for his opponent, for example, in this race, which gives an advantage to the person dominating the airwaves.
Well, we'll check news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio, and then we'll continue to talk about the state of our democracy and wondering what problems there are with our democracy or what's working, and welcome your questions. Our guest wrote for a On Wisconsin magazine piece that democracy is inefficient, messy, and exasperating, but representation is alive and well in the United States. And we'll continue talking about how that is and welcome your thoughts and questions after we check the latest news. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. So what works and what doesn't work when it comes to our democracy? I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We are talking about the state of our democracy and asking whether it works or not on this election day. And we welcome your thoughts, your questions, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. Our guest is Mike Wagner, an assistant professor in the School of Journalism and Mass Communication and the Department of Political Science at UW-Madison. He wrote a piece for On Wisconsin magazine, Does Democracy Work? We have posted that on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page if you'd like to take a look at it. And we thought it would be an interesting discussion on Election Day when we know many of you, most of you, all of you who if you haven't voted already, are planning on voting. I do ask you, remind you that we are asking you to refrain from campaigning on the air today. It's against our policy to have electioneering going on the day of the election. That being said, voter turnout today, Mike Wagner, is predicted to be about 57-58%. Yeah. That's pretty good for a midterm.
That's remarkable. The national average in a presidential is 54%, or I guess 2012 was around 54%. So Wisconsin does very well in terms of voter turnout overall, and incredibly well in midterms where, you know, depending upon how you count the voting age population or the voting eligible population, turnout in the last midterm was between 37% and 39% nationally. But Wisconsin is much higher. And, you know, same day registration's a big reason for that.
I was going to ask what to attribute that to. But at the same time, normally in a presidential election, Wisconsin is up there in the high 60s, close to 70%.
Yeah, right.
So that's through the roof.
Right.
And you say that's because we make it easier to vote with same-day registration.
Yeah, I think that's the major reason. And, you know, that's also just linked to a long-living tradition in our state of being involved when we have a chance to exercise our voice. And there's been an ethic of that in Wisconsin for a long time. And, you know, I suspect that the reason it's easier to vote here than in a lot of other states is tied to that ethic and what voters have demanded of lawmakers. And so that's one reason I think voter turnout is higher here.
But why does it drop off as much as it drops off for the midterm? I mean, 70% is great. 58% is pretty good for a midterm. But still, why isn't it as high as a presidential year?
That's a great question. So it wasn't always this way. When our country started, the midterms were where the action was. And for the first 40 or so years of our country, more people voted in the midterm year than the presidential year because we were this conglomeration of states that were really interested in states' rights and didn't care as much about the presidency. And the president just wasn't as strong as the office of the presidency is today. But from the 1840s or so on, it's been the other way around. And, you know, we have an increasingly president-centric society. The media pays way more attention to the president than to individual members of Congress or Congress itself. Candidates for president spend way more money on elections than candidates for other offices do, even when you add them together in some instances. And so the action in the eyes of the news media and voters tend to be on the presidency. And so voters tend to turn out more in those years. And there's just less information, usually, in midterm elections. Most congressional races are not competitive, and so they don't get a lot of coverage, and they don't have a lot of advertising. And so the information environment out there is not as saturated, and so people are also less likely to show up and participate.
Yeah. So does should we be concerned that not as many people participate in a midterm as they do in a presidential race?
It certainly increases the power of those who show up. And as we were talking about before, those who show up tend to be better off, higher socioeconomic status and those sorts of things. And so when we think about who's getting more representation than others, the demographics of who shows up to vote can make a big difference. There's a really interesting bit of research from some scholars named James Avery and Mark Pefley, where they show that in states where voter turnout is higher amongst economically disadvantaged voters, those states have more generous welfare eligibility requirements, which is to say, when people of lower socioeconomic status show up to vote, states pass laws that are more beneficial to those of lower socioeconomic status. And so who shows up matters for what, you know, our lawmakers do. Yeah. So there are consequences to not showing up.
I guess I'm wondering if there's a number of people who are thinking, you know what, governor, state legislature, whatever, secretary of state, those offices don't really affect me. They, mm-hmm. But, you know, the president and Congress, they affect me.
You know, there is some of that feeling, but part of that is also just we hear way more in the news about the national stuff, at least from the national news media, and local media are covering other things, you know, local crimes and sports and weather and, you know, human interest stories. And there's just less time for local politics in most media markets. And so we just learn less about what these folks are doing. And so they have big effects on our lives. But we hear about it less than we otherwise might.
You know, James Madison essentially wrote that there needs to be an educated electorate in order for democracy to thrive.
Yes.
To what extent do we have that today?
That's a great question. You know, on the one hand, there are lots and lots of educational opportunities that just didn't exist before. And the country has come a long way across a lot of different measures of race and gender and socioeconomic status. And on the other hand, there are lots of inequalities that still persist in education. And so, you know, we're not done, I think, by any means to say that we've done enough to help provide an environment for citizens to have an equal playing field when it comes to decisions to monitor what their elected officials are doing and then decide how they want to vote when elections come around.
Let me ask you, and we do have some other callers who want to talk about money in politics, which
sure.
We can get back to. That's fine. But I wanted to talk about some other issues affecting democracy. I mean, how is the media doing when it comes to providing the information the electorate needs in an election like this one?
Yeah, that's a great question. How we think of the media has really changed in the last 30 years. It's not three television networks and the major papers in your town and the two or three national papers across the country. It's an infinite number of internet sites and a lot of increasingly powerful and you know, extreme cable news outlets that are much more ideological, matching some of the early newspapers that we had in our country's history in terms of the ideology they profess. The news media are a comfortable punching bag for most people. The American people increasingly hold the media in less esteem than they used to. There's a really great book by a Princeton professor named John Ladd called Why Americans Hate the Media and How It Matters. And so there's a lot of evidence out there that public attitudes about the media are pretty negative. And a lot of people point to Fox News or MSNBC or the Drudge Report or the Daily Kos as causing these kinds of problems. On the other hand, the people who are consuming that news are not large in number. You know, far more people watch broad network television news than watch cable news's most highly rated show, The O'Reilly Factor, on any given day. And the people who are watching those partisan shows tend to be watching them because they like it and they want to hear from their side and what their side has to say. And so the people who are most affected by ideological news are the least likely to watch it. And so, you know, there are certainly problems with the way the news media cover politics. And I write about that too, but the effects are a little overstated, I think, in kind of conventional wisdom.
All right. Well, let's go back to the phones. Sheree in Waupun has a media-related comment. Hi, Sheree.
Hi. I wanted to discuss the media not calling people to the carpet, how people can just lie to the electorate without there being much consequence. I think that's really part of our problem, is that people don't do the research as much as they should. And so when things are said, they just tend to accept it as truth and not go forward, even though there is truth out there. It's not being told either in a whole consensus form, or it's just a flat-out lie. And people don't seem to be able to distinguish lies versus just statements.
There's, you know, I'm thinking that there are things like PolitiFact and fact-checking, and sometimes lies are called out, but it's you really gotta hunt around for this information, don't you?
Yeah, the caller hit on an issue that is one of the things that just personally bugs me the most, which is when I'm watching these, you know, interviews on television, and a candidate for office says something where, if you ask them, how do you know that? You feel like you would be pretty likely to get some stunned silence, right? And there are just times when the follow-up questions aren't asked, or the media are broadly afraid to adjudicate a factual dispute because they don't want to get called biased. And so I think the caller is quite right that there are a lot of times when you see this, especially on kind of the Sunday morning television national shows, where the same 10 to 15 people are the guests every week, and they're rarely challenged on their views. And half the questions are, hey, are you going to run for president, and things like that. And it's just very frustrating. And I personally share in that kind of frustration. But as you point out, there are lots of organizations dealing with fact-checking. And PolitiFact is one. FactCheck.org is another. People are starting to study fact-checking now. Lucas Graves in my department in the School of Journalism and Mass Communication is a fact-checking expert. And, you know, shows in his work that it's really difficult sometimes to decide, okay, so what's the precise claim we're going to investigate? And how do we decide whether it's true, or under what conditions is it true? And you see this happening in the governor's race. Governor Walker says, hey, our economy's on the rebound. And over the last year, that's true. And Mary Burke says, hey, we're dead last in the Midwest. And over the last 4 years, that's true. Well, which metric do you want to use? That's a really tough question. And, you know, if you're a Walker supporter, you say the last year matters the most. And if you're a Burke supporter, you say, oh, it's the body of work over the last 4 years that matters the most. But there are more fact checkers. I wish that more people in the moment doing interviews would be prepared to ask tough follow-up questions. I think our politicians get away too easy in those interviews too
often. Good advice. We are talking with Mike Wagner, an assistant professor in the School of Journalism and Communication, Mass Communication, and the Department of Political Science at UW-Madison, talking about our democracy on this election day, and welcoming your thoughts, whether you think there are problems with our democracy. What's the fix in your opinion? Do you think there are good things about our democracy? What do you think is working? 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine. Happy Election Day. On this Election Day, we are talking with our guest expert about democracy and wondering whether democracy really works. Mike Wagner is an assistant professor in the School of Journalism and Mass Communication and the Department of Political Science at UW-Madison, and he wrote about this for On Wisconsin magazine. And I promised we'd get back to the phones a lot of callers want to talk about money and politics. Let's go to Dave in Madison. Hello, Dave.
Yeah, hi. I think that our elected representatives serve two different constituencies, and they're the popular voting constituency and the money constituency, and they both have claims to being part of that democratic process which got them elected. But it seems like whenever there's a conflict between popular constituency and the moneyed constituency, the moneyed constituency always has their concerns taken care of by the elected representative. So if you wanted to say that we have democracy, we do, but it's for the moneyed constituency.
Mike Wagner?
That's a very perceptive point the caller points out. There's a scholar of Congress named Richard Fenno. Almost all the research I've talked about today is quantitative, using statistical analysis to make a point. Fenno followed dozens of Congress members around, just followed them in their home district, sat with them in their cars, asked them lots of questions about why they do what they do, and he found that it's not just two constituencies, as the caller discusses, but there are kind of four. There's the geographic constituency. These are the people I represent. And then there's the re-election constituency. These are the people who vote for me. Then there's the primary constituency. These are the people who support me, give me money, give me volunteer hours, help me. And then there's the personal constituency, which is the very small group of family and advisors. The smaller that concentric circle, the more representation you get. And Fenno's argument is that, you know, those in that primary constituency, the donors, the givers, the volunteers, are getting a lot more. And as, you know, the caller points out, when there's a conflict between the re-election constituency or the geographic constituency and those interests who are giving and working for the candidate, it's pretty tough for the candidate to go against them. And so, you know, we have some kind of qualitative evidence that that exists.
Thank you, Dave. Next, we go to Bernie in Elkhorn. Hello, Bernie.
Hello, good morning. I agree completely on the corrosive influence of money, and all the campaigns should be 100% publicly financed, and the radio, the media, the TV, they should be required to carry equal time at no cost, because they get their licensing at no cost from we the people. Another major point that is rarely talked about is that we need instant runoff voting. We need to be able to rank our candidates one and two. And I'm not talking about the primaries. It does not belong in the primaries, but it belongs in general elections. So that third party and independent voices have a chance. Most people are afraid to vote for them. It's such a trivial thing to institute, but the two major parties have a grip on a monopoly on you know, even the ability to get in a debate in many cases. And we really need instant runoff voting to give our people more discourse and more choices.
I want to start with that last point first.
Yeah, that's an issue that is getting a little bit more attention than it has in years past, where you would rank the candidates. So instead of just voting, you know, for one candidate, you would look at everybody on the slate and maybe rank your top three or something like that. And then the way you would decide who won is, so who had the most ones, the most twos, the most threes, and then you would take the top two and have, you know, a runoff, where you just had to choose one. And so it's a little more complicated. It requires more of us because we have to show up twice, and we don't do a great job as a country of showing up in the first place, but it certainly would be the kind of thing where voters would have an opportunity to express support for a candidate that they might strategically say, I'm not going to vote for under our current system. So you could think back to, say, you know, the 2000 election and say, gosh, well, if I wanted to vote for Ralph Nader, but I want Al Gore to win, I'm going to vote for Al Gore. And so in a runoff where you had to rank candidates, you could say, well, I'll put Nader number one and Gore number two, and hopefully that'll be enough to you know, get Gore in the runoff, or maybe enough people will vote for Nader to get him in the runoff, you know, and which is unlikely, but is still at least more of a possibility under that system than the one that we have. But it's more complicated, it's more costly, it requires more of us. And as the caller, I think, pointed out, the two parties have a pretty strong stranglehold over election law and are not likely to make it harder for them to get what they want.
And would 100% public financing of campaigns and, you know, free TV time make a big difference?
Well, I think when you look at places that do that, you see different campaigns. You don't see these two-year ordeals. You see very short campaign seasons, and you see candidates standing in front of the voters and having to respond to questions from their opponents and the news media. And, you know, there's a lot to like about that. On the other hand, our system gives us a whole lot of time to vet candidates. When you're running for president, you know, there's a couple of years of pretty deep scrutiny of everything that you've ever done. And a lot of it is overblown, but a lot of it can reveal things that we might want to know before we put you at 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue.
Don on Twitter says, when I consider the alternatives, messy democracy looks very good.
Yeah, I agree.
Kind of recap for us. I mean, you're saying that for the most part, it works. There's some problems, but for the most part, it works.
Yeah. You know, I think on balance, our republic is, you know, doing the minimum requirement, which is representing mass views in the policies that government produces. You might say that's a low bar, and maybe we should be doing a better job of representing everybody, or we should be doing a job of more comprehensively being more productive. Congress is not, you know, causing a lot of confidence from the American people, and rightly so. They've performed poorly for a while now and haven't done much, and it's quite right that people are frustrated with that. There are stalemates, and a lot of people who study it argue this is a broken branch of government, and you know we have some pretty serious problems. And despite all of that, and despite all of these problems, on average, when the country has a mood that's more liberal in terms of the policies they prefer, government tends to pass more liberal policies. And when the mood turns more conservative, government tends to pass more conservative policies. And if that relationship goes away, we should worry. That relationship isn't enough for us to say things are hunky-dory, but that's in the right direction, I would say.
So what, maybe our final moments here, is there something that we should be considering to make our democracy work better?
Oh, that's a great question. I wish that's a topic in and of itself. You know, on the citizen side, we need to, I think, spend a little bit more time learning about candidates and learning about what they're doing and participating when an issue that we care about is being discussed publicly, and so that we can engage in some deliberation, whether that's with our lawmakers or with people on Facebook or Twitter or our neighbors or whatever. And I think we could do a better job of trying to hear the other side. Our political opponents are not evil. They see the world in a different way than we do and value different things than we do. And so I think part of our problem is to accept that the other side might have a legitimate point of view. And which isn't to say that we have to think that they're right, but I think we're more likely to advance the ball democratically if we decide that our opponents aren't terrible and honestly would, you know, think that their ideas are what's best. And, you know, states are good laboratories to work that out. Some states have Republican lawmakers in charge, some Democrats, and we can see what policies are working best and go from there.
And that we'll talk to you again when your book comes out, Beyond the Left-Right Divide.
I look forward to it.
Yeah, and you know, you'll be also on tonight for our election coverage. In less than 30 seconds, is there something you'll be watching for?
Voter turnout, I think, is probably the most important thing to look at tonight, and where people are showing up will tell us a lot about who's likely to win.
Well, we'll listen to you tonight, too, on Wisconsin Public Radio's election night coverage. NPR starts at 7, and Wisconsin Public Radio starts when the polls close at 8. Thanks to Mike Wagner, assistant professor in the School of Journalism and Mass Communication and the Department of Political Science at UW-Madison. This is the Ideas Network.